Now, friends, the next heading in this chapter, that is Neoclassic Criticism, Dryden and His Contemporaries, is Essay on Dramatic Poesy, Dryden's Purpose. Even the essay on the fables shows Dryden as the father of comparative and historical criticism, but his manifold critical gifts are fully brought out only by his essay on dramatic poesy. As the essay, published in 1668, is the most ambitiously constructed critical document of his career and the most important for general literary theory, it requires a more detailed and comprehensive treatment. This is the statement of Wimstedt and Brooks. In his address to the reader prefixed to the essay, Dryden says that his aim was to vindicate the honor of our English writers from the censor to those who justly prefer the French before them. However, the real aims of Dryden are much wider. The essay is also an attempt to evolve the principles which ought to guide us in judging a play, as well as an effort to discover the rules which could help a dramatist in writing a good play. The play is also a contribution to two current controversies. First, regarding the comparative superiority of the ancient and the moderns, Dryden demonstrates the superiority of the moderns over the ancients, as also the superiority of contemporary, that is, restoration English dramatists over the dramatists of the last generation, that is, Elizabethan. And second, the comparative merits and demerits of blank verse and rhyme for dramatic purposes. Dryden upholds the superiority of rhymed verse. Then the other subheading is its plan. Thus, in the main, five critical questions are handled in the essay. The first, the relative merits of ancient and modern poets. Second, whether the existing French school of drama is superior or inferior to the English. Third, whether the Elizabethan dramatists were in all points superior to those of Dryden's own time. Fourth, whether plays are more perfect in proportion as they conform to the dramatic rules laid down by the ancients. Fifth, whether the substitution of rhyme for blank verse in serious plays is an improvement. Then the other subheading, occasion. The immediate occasion for the essay was provided by contemporary events. It so happened that in year 1663, a French man named Samuel Sorbier, Sorbierre, visited England on some diplomatic mission, and on returning to France did the undiplomatic thing of publishing an account of his voyage, in which he made some unfavorable remarks about English science and English stage. Sorbier succeeded in provoking one reply, both on scientific and literary grounds, from the historian of the English Royal Society, Thomas Spratt. And it was not long after the incident that John Dryden, courtly poet and dramatist, having apparently stocked his mind with the critical principles of Corneille, Corneille, retired to the country like Milton during the plague years of 1665 and 1666, and in the leisure thus forced upon him, wrote the present essay. The other subheading of this chapter is its form, Dryden's skill in handling of dialogue. The essay in the form of a dialogue in the manner of Plato's Republic, and by his skillful handling of it, Dryden made it into a popular literary form which, according to Wimstedt and Brooks, was to reign supreme in England during the next 75 years. The dialogue is sustained by persons of several opinions, all of them left doubtful, to be determined by the readers in general. This is the great advantage of the dialogue form. No one person states the whole truth. Every speaker contributes to the discussion. There is a free give and take of views. Nothing is stated with any finality, and in the end, the readers are felt to draw their own conclusions. It is the Aristotelian way of practical reasoning which Dryden has successfully used in the essay. The tone is neither dogmatic nor pontifical or magisterial. He displays an openness of mind to opposite argument, almost approaching skepticism, and which Wimstedt and Brooks like to call probabilism. PROBABILISM. Dryden doesn't claim to know the truth. His purpose is gradually, through discussion, to advance towards greater and greater approximation to truth. The other subheading is the setting, its dramatic nature. There are four speakers or interlocutors, and the setting is dramatic. Taking advantage of one of the most notable international relations of the day, the naval battle fought in the Channel between the British and the Dutch on June 3, 1665, Dryden imagines the four gentlemanly and witty interlocutors of his dialogue as drifting in a barge softly down the Thames. The literary discussion in which they are shown evolved comes up through some chance remarks about certain extravagant poems which have recently appeared in the celebration of public events. The other subheading is the four characters, their views, their symbolic significance. As the conversation progresses, an interest in two somewhat similar opposition, that between classicism and modernity, and that between the Elizabethan generation, that is, the last age in English letters, and the present, tends to entangle and temporarily to obscure the lines of the argument, but the main outline is clear. The speaker who first develops his view at length, Crites, C-R-I-T-E-S, that is, standing perhaps for Dryden's brother-in-law, Sir Robert Howard, expounds the extreme classical view that the Greeks and Romans fully discovered and illustrated those reasonable and perennial rules to which the modern drama must conform. In the really minor issue between the last age and the present in England, he maintains the superiority of the last age in making plays, but is nearly ready to recognize the new degree of correctness in versification achieved by Waller and Denham. The recent advantage of English versification to a state of nearly classic perfection is an assumption so solidly established for the other speakers in the dialogue as not to be of main moment to the argument. The second person to speak at length, Eugenius, Eugenius, perhaps Dryden's friend Charles Sackville, Lord Buckhurst, takes the negative position that the ancient poets failed badly in their illustration of the rules prescribed by their critics. The implication is that the moderns have actually best illustrated the rules, but there is little effort to adduce positive evidence for this view. Then thirdly, Lycidius or Sir Charles Sedley, a younger wit of the day, accepting the same premises as Crites and Eugenius that the classical rules for the imitation of nature are indeed the fundamentals of correct dramatic creation, advances the argument that perfect realization of the rules is not to be found in the contemporary English drama, but in the French. Thus, Dryden gives expression to three leading kinds of classicism through these characters, letting them talk themselves about, and it is not until this late point in the essay that the main pivot of the argument occurs with the entrance of Neander, that is, the new man, Dryden himself. He upholds the superiority of the English drama over the French and of rhyme over blank words. The four speakers hardly agree to anything, and having reached their destination, part with mutual courtesy. The readers are left to draw their own conclusions. As shown above, the different characters may stand for some prominent friends and acquaintances of the poet. But what is more to the point is the fact that they are objective representatives of four different points of view. They are symbolic figures representing the different ideas popular in the day. In this way, Dryden has been able to project his views in an inoffensive, indirect, and lively manner. Then the next subheading is critical synopsis. A detailed analysis of the play is necessary to bring out the main argument of the different speakers and throw light on Dryden's views on a number of topics, for the essay is rich in suggestions and though apparently confined to a discussion of dramatic technique, it is the most elaborate statement of Dryden's poetics, that is, the theory of poetry. The next subheading is definition of drama. After some brief introductory remarks regarding the bad verses that are compared to celebrate national events and national figures, the conversation turns on the comparative merits and demerits of ancient and modern poetry. It is then agreed that their discussion should be confined to dramatic poetry, as a preliminary to the more serious discussion to follow. Lycidius defines a play as, "Drama is the lively and just image of human nature, representing its passions and humors and the changes of fortune to which it is subject for the delight and instruction of mankind." All the four speakers agree to this definition. The next subheading. Next, Crites speaks for ancients and he claims superiority for them on the following counts. First, among the ancients, poetry was held in high esteem and poets were highly honored. So there was a healthy competition among them to excel each other. poets were suitably rewarded. Today, the poets have no such encouragement and they are not suitably rewarded. So, poets do not take pains. Second, the ancients were faithful imitators of nature, which is distorted and disfigured in the drama of the day. Third, all the rules of dramatic composition we owe to the classics, and we have added nothing of our own to the rules of Aristotle and Horace. Fourth, the ancients observed the three unities well. The unity of time means that the action should not take more than 24 hours, the natural compass of a day, and it should be equally divided between the acts. This rule was faithfully observed by the ancients. The action begins somewhere towards the end of the fable, and the earlier part was delivered by narration. The English do not follow the unity of time, and therefore they ill represent nature. B. The unity of place means that the same scene should be continued throughout. For the stage being one place, it cannot be represented as many. No doubt there may be some variation of place by the use of painted scenery, but even then it should not shift to places far distant from one another. The French observe this unity, but not the English. The unity of action means that there should be only one great and complete action. Two actions, equally labeled and driven by the writer, would make the play not one play but two plays. However, there may be a number of actions subservient to the main action, as in the plays of Ben Jonson. Such underplots must all be conducive to the main design and be subordinated to it. There is gross violation of these unities in the English drama, which makes it unnatural and improbable. The superiority, therefore, of the ancients is unquestionable. The next subheading is Eugenius takes up the case for the moderns. First, the modern plays are superior to the ancients because the moderns have the advantage of the experience and the rules of ancients, as well as they have life and nature before them which they imitate. The moderns thus have added many new features which the ancients lacked. Just as in the arts and the sciences, the moderns have discovered much that is new, so also in drama. Second, for example, among the ancients, the plays were divided by entrances and not by acts. The division of it into acts was not known to them. It was first given only by Horace. So the Greeks cannot be said to have perfected the art of poesy. Third, their plots were traditional. They were already known to the people and so lacked in novelty and pleasure. So the main aim of poesy, that is to cause delight, was gone. Fourth, they used stock, hackneyed. Hackneyed, hackneyed plots. I repeat this line once again. Fourth, they used stock, hackneyed plots and characters in their comedies. There were certain types which were used in one comedy after another. Then point fifth. Though the ancients devised unities of time, place, and action, they were not perfectly observed by them. A. The unity of place was never the rule of Aristotle nor that of Horace. It has been made into a rule by French. B. The unity of time they often neglected, and often when they observed it, it led them into absurdities, as in Euripides and Terence. Then sixth point. Their plots being narrow and their persons few, their acts are shorter than even the well-wrought scenes in the modern English plays. In other words, their preoccupation with the unities had a cramping effect on their plays. Point 7. There is too much of specifying at the cost of action, and hence monotony and boredom. Point 8. There is no poetic justice in their plays. They often show a prosperous wickedness and an unhappy pity. So their plays neither delight nor instruct. Then point 9. Among the ancients, comedies and tragedies were written by separate dramatists and not by the same person as at present. Hence, they should have achieved perfection in the chosen branch, but they failed to do so. Hence, there is no justification for their shortcomings. Then point 10. Often they are guilty of faulty diction, coinages and metaphors. Point 11. Their tragedies are totally lacking in love scenes. They raise horror by their scenes of lust, cruelty, and bloodshed. Love alone can temper the horror of such scenes. Besides this, love is the most frequent of all the passions, and so it should not be left out. Because of the absence of the moderating influence of love, their tragedies arouse only horror and not compassion. Then the next subheading is, after this, Lycidas takes up the cudgels on behalf of the French drama and demonstrates the superiority of the French over the English. First, the French observe the unities to perfection. A. The unity of time they observe so well that the action is none of their plays exceeds 30 hours. Indeed, they interpret single revolution of the sun to mean 12 hours and not 24, and tried to reduce all plays to this compass. B. They fully observe the unity of place, the entire action being limited to the spot where it began. It is rarely that they go outside the city or town. C. They do not burden their plots with underplots which divert the attention of the audience and the readers. D. They have nothing so absurd as the English tragicomedy, in which we get here a course of mirth, M-I-R-T-H, there another of sadness and passion, and a third of honor and duel. They afford variety, but in a more reasonable manner. The end of tragedy is to beget admiration and compassion or concernment, and this end is defeated by the mingling of mirth. Point 2. The plots of their tragedies are based upon some non-history, but they mix fact with fiction so well that they are able to arouse concernment even though the plot is a non-one. In this respect, they have excelled the ancients. They are never guilty of the absurdities of Shakespeare, who cramps the business of 30 years into 2 or 3 hours. Thus, there is no just representation of nature, but a drawing of her in miniature. This, instead of making a play delightful, makes it ridiculous. The English are not true to nature. Third point, there is no multiplicity of action and incident in their plays, and so there is enough time to represent one passion well and fully instead of being hurried from one to another as in the English plays. Point 4. No doubt in their plays one character is exalted above the rest, but due attention is also paid to other characters and every one of them is given a suitable role to play. Point 5. The French manage their narrations or relations much more skillfully than the English. The narration of events antecedent to the play, but necessary for its understanding, is generally avoided with a great skill by the suitable management of the plot itself. There are relations of events that have happened off the stage, and through such relations they avoid the tumult and violence of English stage. Everything too cruel, obnoxious, absurd, or unnatural is thus kept out. In this way, they avoid the ridicule of showing death on the stage. All passions may find a just and lively representation on the stage, but not all actions, and dying is one of them. Narration is also necessary to reduce the plot to a more reasonable compass of time. Point 6. There are no sudden changes or conversations in their plays as in the English. Point 7. They use rhyme, which is to be preferred to the English blank words. The use of rhyme beautifies a play. The next subheading of this chapter is Neander or Dryden speaks last of all. He demonstrates the superiority of the English over the French and of the moderns over the ancients. His first point. There is no doubt that the French plays are more regular and the laws better followed, and it is also true that the English plays have many irregularities, but neither our faults nor their virtues are considerable enough to place them above us. Second, they lack the rich variety of humor in the English plays. Third, Molière and some other French dramatists have started mingling tragedy and comedy, serious and the gay, in the manner of the English. Point 4th. Their plots are too much alike to please often. They lack variety. Point 5. Dryden then passes on to justify tragicomedy. He does so on the following grounds. A. Contraries set off each other. B. A scene of mirth introduced in a tragedy refreshes and provides relief. C. Compassion and mirth do not destroy each other. They are found together in nature also. D. Tragic comedy is a pleasant way of writing, not known to the ancients or to the moderns of any other nation. Point 6. The English plots are copious and varied, the French barren and narrow. They have only a single action. We have underplots or by concernments, which, however, move with the main action, and so the unity of action is not destroyed. Thus, there is a combination of variety with unity and therefore greater pleasure. Point 7. Their preoccupation with a single theme does not give them any advantage in the expression of passion. Their verses are cold, and the long speeches in their plays are tiresome. During the performance of a French play, we are concerned for our own troubles instead of being concerned for their imaginary heroes. Point 8. Long speeches may suit the genius of the French, they do not suit the English, who are a more sullen people and come to the stage for refreshment. Point 9. Short speeches and replies are more likely to move the passions, and wit and repartee are the chief graces of comedy. In the chase of wit, the English have reached perfection and are superior to the French. Point 10. The more the characters in a play, the greater will be the variety. Only this variety should be so managed that there is no confusion, and this skill has been attained by the great English dramatists like Ben Jonson. Then point 11. As regards showing of violent action on the stage, differences of temperament should be taken into account. The English are fierce by nature and prefer action on the stage. Point B. As regards incredibility, if the audience can imagine an actor to be a king, they can also imagine three soldiers to be an army. Point C. Only death should not be shown on the stage. Point D. If the English have too much action, the French have too little. Point E. A mean or middle path should be followed. The incredible or indecent should not be shown, but what is beautiful must be acted on the stage. Then the point 12. The French dramatist Corneille himself admitted that the unities have a cramping effect. The plot becomes narrow and barren, and many beauties have to be omitted. Strict adherence to the unities often results in absurdities. The English may violate the unities, but their plots have greater variety and are more copious. Then point 13. Many of the English plays are as regular as the French, and in addition have greater variety of plot and character. In the irregular plays of Shakespeare and Fletcher, there is greater spirit and more masculine fancy than in any of the French. Ben Jonson's plays are as correct as those of the French. Then point 14. Then follow the critical estimates of Shakespeare, Beaumont and Fletcher and Jonson, and we get the remarkable sentence, "I admire him," that is Jonson, "but I love Shakespeare." Ben may be more correct, but Shakespeare has greater wit. If Shakespeare was the Homer, Jonson was the Virgil of England. Dryden's appreciation of the dramatists of the last age is the dearest moment in the history of national self-appreciation. "The great work of Dryden in criticism," says T.S. Eliot, "is that at the right moment he became conscious of the necessity of affirming the native element in literature." Of Shakespeare, he enthusiastically says that of all modern and ancient poets, he had the largest and the most comprehensive shawl, and that he was naturally learned. In such moments, Dryden is no longer a neoclassic, but goes over to the other camp, the romantic. Then point 15. Then follows the detailed examine of Ben Jonson's Silent Women, a play which has the three unities and the continuity of scenes. It is faultlessly constructed strictly according to the rules of the ancients. There is also variety of characters and humors. Almost in a modern manner, humor is defined as some extravagant habit, passion, or affection particular to some one person by the oddity of which he is at once distinguished from the rest of men. The intrigue in the play is the greatest and the most noble of any pure, unmixed comedy in any language. Then point 16. Dryden shows his national prejudice when he says that our present poets have far surpassed all the ancients and the modern writers of other countries. Then the discussion turns on rhyme and blank verse, and Keats attacks rhyme violently. First, rhyme is not to be allowed in serious plays, though it may be allowed in comedies. Second, rhyme is unnatural in a play, for a play is in dialogues, and no man without premeditation speaks in rhyme. Third, blank verse is also unnatural, for no man speaks in verse either, but it is nearer to prose, and Aristotle had laid down that tragedy should be written in a verse form, which is nearest to prose. Fourth, drama is a just representation of nature, and rhyme is unnatural, for nobody in nature expresses himself in rhyme. It is artificial, and the art is too apparent, while the true art consists in hiding art. Fifth point. It is said that rhyme helps the poet to control his fancy, but one who has not the judgment to control his fancy in blank verse will not be able to control it in rhyme either. Artistic control is a matter of judgment and not of rhyme or verse. Neander replies to Crates and speaks in defense of rhyme. His first point is, it is the choice of words and placing of them, natural words in a natural order, that makes the language natural, whether it is verse or rhyme that is used. His second point, rhyme itself may be made to look natural by the use of pun on lines, and variety resulting from the use of hemistich, manipulation of pauses and stresses, and the change of meter. Third point, thus rhyme can be made natural, and it has the added advantage of sweetness. Fourth point, blank verse is no verse at all. It is simply poetic prose and so fit only for comedies. Rhymed verse alone, made natural or near to prose, is suitable for tragedy. This would satisfy Aristotle's dictum. Then fifth, rhyme is justified by its universal use among all the civilized nations of the world. Then point sixth, the great Elizabethans achieved perfection in the use of blank verse, and they, the moderns, cannot excel them or achieve anything significant or better in the use of blank words. Hence, they must perforce use rhyme, which suits the genius of our age. Then point 7. It is liked by the nobility whose judgment alone counts. Then point 8. Tragedy is a serious play representing nature exalted to its highest pitch, rhyme being the noblest kind of verse is suitable to it and not to comedy. Then point 9. Rhyme is an aid to judgment. Men of ordinary judgment, as even the best of poets are, require some help and write better because of that help. Rhyme helps the judgment and thus makes it easier for the poets to control the free flight of their fancy. Then conclusion. By this time, their bars reaches its destination. They alight and separate, bidding courteous farewell to each other. The discussion has been tentative and exploratory. No definite conclusions have been reached, and the readers have been left free to think for themselves and decide for themselves. This highly balanced and civilized approach, this urbane tone and manner, is praised highly by Dr. Tilliard, who writes, "This perfection of tone in manners of comparative literature that was not equaled before or since is Dryden's paramount critical achievement." Let us now examine briefly Dryden's views on a variety of topics as expressed in the essay. The first topic is the definition of drama, nature and function of poetry, poetic imitation. The definition. Throughout the essay, drama is treated as a form of imaginative literature, and hence Dryden's remarks on drama apply to poetry as well. The very definition of a play given in the very beginning is expressive of his view of poetry. Drama is defined as a just and lively image of human nature, representing its passions and humors and the changes of fortune to which it is subject for the delight and instruction of mankind. According to this definition, drama is an image of human nature, and that the image is just as well as lively. By using the word just, Dryden seems to imply that literature imitates and not reproduces human actions. For Dryden, poetic imitation is different from an exact servile copy of reality. For the imitation is not only just, it is also lively. David Dacez examines the implication of these words in detail. In his view, the image of human nature implies that drama, or imaginative literature in general, shows people acting in such a way as to reveal what they are like. By the use of the word image, Dryden seems to be emphasizing the appearance of human actions, quite untroubled by Plato's notion that to do so is simply to imitate an imitation. Dryden makes no distinction, in fact, between an image or appearance of human nature and the truth about human nature. The former, if it is just, gives the latter. The next subheading of this chapter is poetic imitation. Further, the image is not only to be just, it must also be lively. While David Dacez takes lively to mean interesting, the antithesis to dull. R.A. Scott James takes lively to mean beautiful and so delightful. The poet is a maker or creator, and he aims at making something more beautiful. He says, The poet does not leave things as he finds them, but handles them, treats them, heightens their quality, and so creates something that is beautiful and his own. Dryden himself describes the process as follows. In general, the employment of a poet is like that of a curious gunsmith or watchmaker. The iron or silver is not his own, but they are the least part of that which gives the value. The price lies wholly in the workmanship, and he who works duly on a story without moving laughter in a comedy or raising concernment in a serious play is no more to be accounted a good poet than a gunsmith of the minories is to be compared with the best workman of the town. In other words, in poetry there is no mere reproduction of reality. The poet has imagination, and it is by the shaping power of his imagination that the poet selects, orders, rearranges his material, and thus gives a more heightened and beautiful version of reality. It is not slavish imitation, but imaginative creation that Dryden means by the just and lively image of human nature. His image of human nature is just because it is basically true, and it also lively, for it is more heightened and beautiful reproduction. Dryden's essay makes it quite clear that he lays more emphasis on the liveliness of the image than on its justness. Thus, the irregular plays of Shakespeare are praised for their liveliness. The next subheading is the function of poetry. Elsewhere, in his defense of the essay on dramatic poesy, he writes, "Delight is the chief, if not the only end of poesy. Instruction can be admitted, but in the second place, for poesy only instructs as it delights." It is true that to imitate well is a poet's work, but to affect the soul, to excite the passions, and above all to move admiration, which is the delight of serious plays, a bare imitation will not serve. Thus it becomes clear that a bare imitation will not serve the ends of poetry, which are to instruct and delight the poetry, instructs as it delights. Instruction is secondary and delight the first, the primary function of poetry. In this way, in emphasizing the delight of poetry, Dryden is far in advance of his age, in which instruction was regarded as the chief aim of poetry. The question then arises how poetry fulfills his function. How does it instruct and how does it delight? According to David Dacez, the instruction which poetry gives is psychological. It is a better understanding of human nature, a keener insight into the working of the human mind and heart that we get from poetry. The learned critic writes, "You obtain a just and lively image of human nature by representing its passions and humors." Humors meaning states of mind or mental characteristics, and by representing the changes of fortune to which men are subject. It is only when we see a character's reaction to changes of fortune that we get a real view of his passions and humors. It is the testing circumstances that illuminate character. The function of poetry would thus be to inform the reader in a lively and agreeable way of what human nature is like. Literature would be form of knowledge, and it would bear the same relation to psychology as in Sydney it does to ethics. That is, while for Sydney the poet makes vivid and impressive by his imaginary examples the ideas of moral philosopher, show for Dryden the poet makes vivid and impressive by his imaginary examples the knowledge of the psychologist. However, Scott James seems to be nearer the truth when he emphasizes that it is aesthetic delight at which the poet aims. Delight or pleasure may be of different kinds, and delight which is proper to poetry is the delight which arises from a contemplation of the beautiful. He says, but the pleasure which a work of art produces is of a certain kind. It is that which arises from a sense of the beautiful. Dryden does not for a moment consider the possibility that the end of art can be dissociated from beauty. For him, as for Aristotle, it goes without saying that when you speak of poetry or art, you are speaking of beauty, and if you speak of pleasure of poetry, you mean a pleasure arising out of the beautiful. It is only such a aesthetic delight that has the power to move, the power of transport, the power in Dryden's words to affect the soul and excites the passions, and above all to move admiration. The soul is moved and transported to the appreciation of the beautiful, and since the beautiful in human actions and passions is also the noble, the good, and the moral, an appreciation of beauty means an appreciation of the good and the noble also. The next subheading of this chapter is Imagination and Judgment. It is in this way that poetry instructs as it delights. For this purpose, a bare imitation of reality will not do, but reality must be selected, ordered, and shaped by the poet's imagination, just as a skilled workman shapes his raw material to create or make beautiful works of art. Poetic imagination transforms and transmutes reality, but in effecting such transmutation, the poet may not remain just, he may falsify reality. Therefore, the excesses of poetic imagination must be curbed and controlled, and such a control is exercised by the judgment of the poet. This imagination enables a poet to give a lively picture of human nature, while his judgment keeps the picture just. Then conclusion. To conclude, Dryden's concept of poetic imitation is not mere slavish copying of nature. Poetic representation is not mere imitation, for it is the work of a poet or maker or creator whose concern it is to produce something that is beautiful. No realistic or neutralistic doctrine could have satisfied Dryden, for on his presupposition that the artist is concerned with beautiful and with producing pleasure through the medium of beauty, he cannot be interested in the representation of life just because it is life, but only in the representation of life so far as it is beautiful. According to Dryden, the artist aims at making something more beautiful than life. It is only such a making that can enable poetry to perform the function proper to it. Then the next subheading is Dryden's liberal classicism, the three unities, tragicomedy, comparison with Dr. Johnson. Dryden's liberal classicism. Dryden stands out prominently as a champion of liberal classicism in an age steeped in the grammar of criticism derived from Boileau and other French critics. In an age of finicky criticism with its precise rules and definitions, Dryden had the boldness to defend the claims of genius to write according to its own convictions without regard for the prescriptions and rules which had been laid down for good writing. He cleared the ground for himself by brushing away all the arbitrary bans upon freedom of composition and freedom of judgment. He refused to be cowed down by the French playwrights and critics. As David Deutsch writes, changing tastes and interests helped to make him responsive to different kinds of literary skill and of artistic conventions, and thus giving him that primary qualification of the good practical critic, the ability to read the work under consideration with full and sympathetic understanding. He refused to pay servile homage even to Aristotle. He writes, "It is not enough that Aristotle had said so, for Aristotle drew his models of tragedy from Sophocles and Euripides, and if he had seen ours, might have changed his mind." Dryden's attitude to the ancients was not that of idolatry. Professor Tilliard writes, "Freed from a superstitious regard for the ancients, he used his common sense and skill to look at them quite coolly and with no more initial respect which he accorded to the writers of his own day. The result is that perfection of tone in matters of comparative literature that has not been equaled before or since. And this is his paramount critical achievement, according to W.P. Kerr. His virtue is that in a time when literature was pestered and cramped with formulas, he found it possible to write otherwise than freely. He is a skeptical, tentative, disengaged, disengaged, where most of his contemporaries and most of his successors for 100 years are pledged to certain dogmas and principles."